the reading of the Cedar Rapids Gazette for Sunday. I am your reader, Sharon Faldudo. I am reading this to you from my kitchen table in Coralville. On the front page of today's Gazette, above the fold, church bells peal again for Easter, accompanied by a photograph of a large church bell. Peggy Brecht of Norway rings one of three bells during a March 28th dedication ceremony for the three church bells at St. Michael's Catholic Church. Turmoil of derecho and virus yield to hope by Grace King of the Gazette in Norway, Iowa. The congregation at St. Michael's Catholic Church in Norway is celebrating Easter Sunday as a community, a year after the pandemic sidelined most Easter celebrations and nearly 8 months after the derecho damaged its three bells. The August 10, 2020 derecho tore the 130-year-old steeple off the historic building and damaged the bells that ring before services every Sunday. The bells were shined up and repaired in Ohio and are now back in their rightful place at St. Michael's, 512 Evergreen Street in Norway. On the March 28th Palm Sunday, the bells were blessed by the Reverend Greg Steimel before being installed later that week. Palm Sunday commemorates Jesus Christ's entry into Jerusalem the week before his crucifixion and resurrection. Steimel said the bells tie the congregation back to the original settlers of this area 130 years ago. "It gives us a connection to them," he said. "The people who are still living here are relatives to the people who purchased the bells and saw them installed back then. It's a connection to their family histories and ties us back to the original days in the parish." The pageantry of Holy Week was reduced because of the pandemic, but Steimel said it's better than last year when they could hold no in-person services. Last year, Governor Kim Reynolds limited group gatherings to no more than 10 people, including churches, to mitigate the spread of COVID-19. In April 2020, she lifted restrictions for places of worship, saying that spiritual and religious places were no longer prohibited from holding gatherings. Church leaders across eastern Iowa now are seeing more people return to in-person church in recent months after they get vaccinated. Steimel said he has been vaccinated and is looking forward to gathering with everyone again soon. "Jesus said, 'Where two or more are gathered, there I am,'" Steimel said. "We want to see each other, be with each other, serve each other, and care for one another just like Jesus did." St. Pius X Catholic Church, 4949 Council Street Northeast in Cedar Rapids, held its first service in its sanctuary since the derecho on Palm Sunday. The congregation previously had been gathering in the parish hall with social distancing and masks required. "Being able to hold services in the sanctuary again is perfectly timed with Easter Sunday," said Michael Becker, St. Pius X pastoral associate. "Holy Week in 2020 was very difficult with not being able to gather as a community for Good Friday and Easter Sunday. It was a somber experience," Becker said, "the opposite of what Easter is supposed to be." While the congregation is continuing social distancing, marking off every other pew to remain empty, and requiring masks, Becker said there is joy and excitement on parishioners' faces. Many are returning to in-person church for the first time in over a year after receiving a COVID-19 vaccine. "It's a joyous occasion, but we want to be as cautious as we can so we're not putting people's health at risk," he said. "Celebrating together, even at limited capacity, we can still do that." On Easter 2020, First Assembly of God, 3233 Blairs Ferry Road Northeast in Cedar Rapids, held a drive-in service. Attendees were required to stay in their cars with their windows up. The service was broadcast through a radio station. The church also distributed hope kits filled with Easter eggs, a tradition it continued this year. The church distributed 700 kits with 2,400 Easter eggs. Pastor Brian Pingle held five Easter services in a smaller part of First Assembly's building. This was to maintain social distancing while the sanctuary is undergoing construction after being damaged by the derecho. Pingle said the estimated cost of the damage is up to almost $6 million. The church is back up to 60% attendance from before the beginning of the pandemic. "At this point, we're not still fully back together," Pingle said. "There is hope, and I think that's the most encouraging. We know hope is alive, and that's what Easter is all about." And also from the front page of today's Gazette, health officials plan to aim vaccines at vulnerable, NAACP to host vaccination clinic for people of color, by Michaela Ram of the Gazette. Local health departments, in the midst of targeted outreach to vulnerable populations, say the contamination of millions of coronavirus vaccines should not have an impact on the additional allocation of doses that are anticipated to arrive this week. Both Lynn and Johnson County Public Health Departments expect to receive hundreds of doses of the one-shot COVID-19 vaccine manufactured by Johnson & Johnson, which officials plan to direct to populations that face barriers to finding and obtaining the vaccine. The first targeted mass vaccination clinic is scheduled for Cedar Rapids this week to reach people of color who have faced disproportionately high rates of infection and death over the past year. Hosted by the Cedar Rapids NAACP, the clinic aims to vaccinate 100 people using the Johnson & Johnson shot, which was allocated by Linn County Public Health. The clinic will take place every 2 days, Tuesday and Saturday. "We want the community as a whole to be safer for everyone," said Dedrick Doolin, Cedar Rapids NAACP president. However, news this past week about a human error at a manufacturing lab, which resulted in the contamination of millions of doses of the Johnson & Johnson vaccine, may have soured some residents' desire to get the jab, local advocates say. That has added another layer to the challenge for local public health officials and other community leaders to address among certain vulnerable populations, some of whom already may have been on the fence about getting the shot, due to misinformation and chronic distrust of government entities, among a multitude of other reasons. Linn County Public Health is expected to receive 1,200 doses of the Johnson & Johnson vaccine set aside especially for officials to administer to vulnerable or at-risk residents, said Heather Mador, the agency's clinical services supervisor. Johnson County Public Health will receive 500 doses, also directed specifically to hard-to-reach county residents. Sam Jarvis, the agency's community health manager, didn't specify whether the county was planning any mass vaccination clinics at this time, but noted the department is hopeful these allocations will continue in the future. The state won't see an effect on its Johnson & Johnson allocations this week or next week, an Iowa Department of Public Health spokeswoman said Thursday, adding that the department will update stakeholders on any potential downstream impacts as soon as possible. The contamination originated at a Baltimore plant, but does not affect any doses being delivered or currently used nationwide, according to the New York Times. However, it's unclear how it will impact the 24 million doses expected to be shipped from the facility over the next month. That news was enough to prompt some to reconsider visiting next week's vaccine clinic hosted by the Cedar Rapids NAACP. Doolin said he has received calls from residents who say they're not confident in the Johnson & Johnson vaccine and now are on the verge of giving up their scheduled spot. Doolin said those calls still are few compared to others, eager to receive any protection against the coronavirus. However, anything that may prompt some to opt out of the vaccine is a major concern for those advocating for vulnerable populations locally. "If someone wants the shot, we're trying to do our best to make sure the vaccine is available to them and that they don't have to wait a long period of time," Doolin said. The Cedar Rapids NAACP decided to host a vaccine clinic targeted to people of color because there's a need for it, Doolin said. "As with many Iowans, residents of color have struggled to obtain a shot in recent weeks, but many of those individuals face additional barriers. For example, some can't take the time to drive several miles for an appointment in another town, as some Iowans have opted to do. In addition, national polling shows people of color tend to be more hesitant to take the vaccine compared to other groups. Many experts have attributed that to a distrust of government officials, as well as historical trauma that resulted from events such as the 40-year Tuskegee untreated syphilis study and other experiments conducted on Black Americans over the years. Doolin said some residents believe they've been treated poorly by the medical profession, leading them to cut those relationships. "At this point, NAACP Cedar Rapids is not involved in urging people to get a vaccination, Doolin said. "However, that could change in coming weeks and months as the vaccine supply increases and public health officials work to ensure protection against the virus through herd immunity." Doolin said he's concerned in particular about misinformation about the vaccines that's making its way through the community by social media or other means. "Misinformation also is a major concern among advocates working to reach immigrant and refugee communities, many of whom hail from African countries and experience some of the same challenges Black Americans face," said Mugisha Buenge, chief executive officer of not-for-profit United We March Forward. "Not only is it difficult to get factual information to these families, but that material has to be in their language and translated in a way that is culturally appropriate," Buenge noted. Organizations such as the Catherine McCauley Center in Cedar Rapids have worked in recent weeks to gather and distribute that information to the clients they work with. But Buenge said it's also a matter of having conversations with families and addressing their individual concerns about the vaccines. "In many cases, talking to someone who already has had the shot can be enough to address their fears," he said. "We can't understand what everyone is thinking, so we have to make sure we're providing factual information, making sure they know the vaccine is safe," Buenge said. Linn County public health officials challenged the state this week on its decision to allocate shipments of the Johnson & Johnson vaccine to colleges and certain large employers instead of setting aside those doses for vulnerable populations. "The one-shot vaccine is ideal to reach populations that face barriers to getting to clinics, as well as those who may be lost in the follow-up for the second dose, such as those who experience homelessness." The letter, which was dated March 31st and sent to top leadership of the Iowa Department of Public Health, was written by the county agency's Community Health Division Manager, Tricia Kitzman. "It is becoming increasingly clear that the governor's office does not trust local public health to identify and serve individuals in our community who are most vulnerable," Kitzman wrote. Even as the vaccine rollout continues, public health officials remain wary of increasing numbers of infected Iowans. In recent weeks, new COVID-19 cases and related hospitalizations are on the rise nationwide, prompting federal officials to encourage Americans to not let their guard down, and President Joe Biden to urge states to reinstate mitigation measures. Though other states have seen a higher increase in recent weeks, Iowa has experienced only a slight uptick in new cases. Linn County Public Health's Mador said local officials, with St. Patrick's Day celebrations and spring break traveling over the past month, were concerned about a new wave of infections, but so far there has been a small increase in cases, not an explosion, meaning contact tracing and vaccine distribution is still very manageable for public health and local vaccine providers. Even when faced with a higher case count, officials don't anticipate a surge in cases would hinder vaccine rollout, they say. While officials are beginning to see good results in congregate areas such as long-term care facilities, it's a reminder the vaccine has not yet offered full protection to the community as a whole. As a result, public health officials are continuing to urge residents to practice COVID-19 mitigation strategies. We continue to remind everyone the number of people vaccinated is far less than people who have not been vaccinated, Mador said. Yes, more and more people are getting vaccinated, and we're grateful for that, but we've not reached herd immunity. And some numbers from the Gazette today. Iowa sees 39,706 more vaccinations, no new virus deaths reported for the day. Iowa administered an additional 39,706 coronavirus vaccines as of 11 a.m. Saturday for the previous 24-hour period. That takes the total number of individuals fully vaccinated to 652,349. Linn County has seen 20.93% of its population receive a full series of coronavirus vaccinations, according to Iowa Department of Public Health data and as analyzed by the Gazette. That is 1,141 more than Friday for a total of 47,450. Johnson County has 24.73% of its population fully vaccinated at 37,378 residents, 994 than the morning before. Of the 608 new cases of COVID-19 noted by Iowa Department of Public Health data and as analyzed by the Gazette, Linn County added a dozen cases with a 7-day average of 20. Johnson County reported 39 new cases for the 24-hour period as of Saturday morning. Its 7-day average stood at 24. 76 new cases were recorded statewide for children. Adults working in the education field added only one. The top 10 counties in total cases were number 1, Polk, 54,789. Number 2, Linn, 19,950. Number 3, Scott, 18,244. Number 4, Blackhawk, 15,327. Number 5, Woodbury, 14,611. Number 6, Johnson, 13,634. Number 7, Dubuque, 12,810. Number 8, Dallas, 10,714. Number 9, Pottawatomie, 10,411. And number 10, Story, 10,132. The New York Times listed 30.6 million cases nationwide as of early Saturday afternoon. The state has seen 5,822 confirmed deaths connected to virus over the past year. However, no new deaths were listed for Saturday. The 68 deaths reported by the Iowa Department of Public Health were claimed as adjustments since October 2020. The New York Times reported 553,907 deaths as of Saturday. The number of hospitalized patients dropped by 4 from Friday for a total of 200. 44 patients were in intensive care and 20 were on ventilators, the state reported. The number of long-term care facilities with outbreaks remained at 2, unchanged from the day before. Neither outbreak was in the corridor. The number of people connected to such centers who have died from COVID-19 stood at 2,275. From the Iowa Today page, CAM bus driver becomes uneasy hero after stopping a suicide. UI student sensed a woman was in trouble as she stood at the edge of a bridge. By Trish Mahaffey of the Gazette in Iowa City. If Ben Koch hadn't seen bright pink out of the corner of his eye, he might not have saved a life. Koch, 22, a University of Iowa student, was driving his UI CAM bus route along Grand Avenue on August 28, 2020, when he'd stopped at Riverside Drive to turn left. He saw the flash of pink and looked over to see a woman wearing a pink shirt sitting on top of the Burlington Street Bridge's outer railing that overlooks the River Dam. He knew something was wrong and sat at the intersection as the left turn arrow came and went. The woman then went over the railing to stand on the edge of the bridge, looking into the river's swift current. I thought at first, are my eyes deceiving me? Koch told the Gazette last week. I thought, she is going to jump. I got on our communications radio to let them know what was going on and to call 911. Koch, who grew up in Dubuque, recalled looking around to see if an Iowa City police officer might be driving by. A car had stopped near the woman, and the female driver rolled down her car's window and seemed to be talking to the woman on the bridge. I just put the bus in park and jumped out, booking it fast as I could across the intersection and dodging some cars that had the green light to get to the bridge, Coke said, as he relived the moment. It was probably like 500 feet away. I just grabbed her under her arms from behind and wrapped my arms around her to hold her, and then another man came up and helped me pull the woman over the railing away from the edge. Coke, who is 6'6", said he knew he could hold the woman until police arrived, but he didn't know if he could get her over the railing by himself. So he was grateful for the other man's help. She really didn't say anything to me, Coke said. She was yelling, and I heard her say she wanted to die. She was crying and seemed frustrated. She wasn't making much sense. Coke said it was instinct that made him stop and help. He said he's had experience with mental health issues in his family and among his friends, which makes him aware of potential problems. He said he sensed the woman was in trouble. We all go through stuff, he said. I have. After experiencing this, and my dad had died 2 years ago, and my grandfather died before Christmas, I needed some counseling. Coke said he continued to hold the woman until police officers arrived, about 7 of them. They thanked him and the other man for their help and credited Coke with saving the woman's life. Coke then went back to his busload of freshmen, who he thought might be upset with him for making some of them late to class. Instead, they were standing and clapping when he opened the CAM bus doors. Nobody was griping, he said. They were saying, "You saved her life. You're a hero." It was pretty great. I apologized for making them late and told them if they ever need help to reach out to someone. The American Red Cross Grant Wood chapter named Coke one of its everyday heroes of eastern Iowa last month. The 18th annual presentation was March 11th in a virtual event held to recognize citizens who display courage, compassion, and unselfish character. Other honorees were Tina Mead and her second helping meal service in Manchester, Bill Ganson and Joe Main, City of Dubuque employees who used CPR and an automated external defibrillator to revive a man who had a heart attack at the city's landfill, and Red Cross biomedical staffers who continued safe blood collections during the pandemic. Coke said he felt uneasy being called a hero but was honored by the award. I felt like the others awarded deserved it more for what they did, but it's pretty cool, Coke said. Brian McClatchy, CAM bus manager and Coke supervisor, said he wasn't surprised Coke tried to help that day. He is a good employee and always goes above and beyond, McClatchy said. I've always thought highly of him. I was impressed that he saw the woman that day. I'm real proud of him. McClatchy says Coke has been driving for CAM bus since November 2017 and has consistently been complimented by his passengers, he said. Coke also received a director's award and a small scholarship from the university's parking and transportation department for his life-saving action. I just always try to be aware of what's going on and watch out for the passengers. It's part of the job, Coke said. I just hope everyone remembers you don't have to be a hero to reach out to someone and talk. It may help. Turning to the Insight page, and there isn't a Gazette editorial today, so I will read the Gazette's columnists first. Adam Sullivan's At Liberty column, Democrats vie for the back the blue mantle. Governor Kim Reynolds this past week signed a bill that promises to reduce racial disparities in the justice system. Oddly, it was Republicans leading the way and Democrats defending the status quo. During gun policy debates in the Iowa legislature last month, Democrats fell all over themselves to proclaim that they are the real Back the Blue party. They read statements from their local police officers and pitched a series of amendments intended to give cops the tools they need to fight crime. House File 756 was approved by both chambers last month and is set to take effect in July. Under the bill, permits to carry or require a handgun will become optional. It's known as constitutional carry by some advocates. Federally licensed firearm dealers still will be required to perform background checks before selling to unpermitted buyers. Iowans still can get permits from their local sheriff's office if they want to purchase multiple guns in a 5-year period without undergoing a new background check each time, or if they need a carry permit while traveling to another state. Democrats opposing the bill emptied a magazine of tough-on-crime talking points and shot holes through the truth. This bill bans or kills background checks in this state. There's no doubt about it, said Representative Beth Wessel Kreschel, Democrat Ames. For that to be true, all federally licensed firearm dealers in Iowa would have to go out of business and no Iowan would seek a permit to carry out of state. Seems doubtful. The truth is, most gun sales in the United States happen with a background check, and that's unlikely to change under Iowa's new gun rights package. PolitiFact in 2018 reviewed a Democratic presidential candidate's claim that a quarter of guns are sold without background checks. Fact-checkers rated that mostly false, citing a survey that found about 13% of gun owners purchased guns without a background check. Detractors are particularly worried about private sales between individuals outside the federally regulated system. Democrats debating the bill employed racist tropes about bad guys lurking in the alleys. They spun up hypothetical situations about people doing stuff they can already do, undetected by law enforcement. Under current law, private handgun sales require the buyer to have a permit to acquire. The bill will remove that requirement, but provide new penalties for people who knowingly sell guns to ineligible buyers. Critics say that will be difficult to enforce, but so is the status quo. Firearm restrictionists love to mention they are gun owners or grew up around guns. Those in the Iowa legislature are powerful, privileged, and overwhelmingly white, so of course they think they should be allowed to own guns. Some of them are old enough that their childhood shooting memories predate the modern permit system. It's the common people they want us to be afraid of. Many progressives can see the untenability and racist impact of our drug laws, but they somehow can't see how the same applies to guns. Black Iowans are much more likely to be convicted under gun control laws than white Iowans. Black people make up less than 4% of the state's population, but they accounted for more than a quarter of convictions for acquiring a handgun without a permit in 2019, according to a Minority Impact report from the Legislative Services Agency. Analysts concluded the bill will have a beneficial effect on the law's disproportionate minority impact. The law being enacted in Iowa is estimated to reduce convictions by hundreds each year and save the justice system up to $4.7 million annually, although new criminal offenses created by the legislation could counteract that progress. The gun control lobby says it's already easy enough to get a gun permit in Iowa. That's probably easy to say if you've never purchased a handgun in Iowa. Former Democratic Governor Chet Culver signed a law in 2010 bolstering gun rights. The law diminished sheriff's discretion in granting gun permits, codifying that the sheriff shall issue a permit to any eligible applicant. Yet county sheriffs still have considerable discretion over their permitting process. Sheriffs can allow for online applications, but many don't. If the sheriff drags out the process and withholds a permit for several weeks, citizens have little recourse. At the peak of a deadly infectious disease pandemic last year, my local sheriff was still making folks come to the office to hand over paperwork. That happens to be the same building as the county jail, a potential COVID-19 hotspot. There's a new sheriff in town, but he's also making constituents file their applications in person as the pandemic is ongoing. Under the new gun rights law, thousands of Iowans still will be barred from possessing firearms, even though many of them pose no serious threat to the public. Because of racial disparities in the justice system, any law restricting felon rights has a racist impact. Even on this politically charged subject, there is room for bipartisan agreement. Recently, the House unanimously passed a bill to expunge certain low-level felony convictions, which would allow some former offenders to regain their firearm rights. Democratic State Representative Mary Wolf, a defense attorney who opposed the gun rights omnibus, acknowledged the existing regulatory regime is too complicated. Some Iowans who are ineligible to possess guns might not even know it. That's our fault. We write the laws, and some of them are Byzantine, and nobody understands them, said Wolf, Democrat Clinton. And Adam Sullivan's, Todd Dorman's 24-hour doorman column, Caucuses in Trouble, What's New? A lone rider gallops through the night, past farms and through sleepy villages, his voice cutting through the night like the glare from his lantern. The Iowa caucuses are in trouble. The Iowa caucuses are in trouble, he cries. They may no longer be the first in the nation. What's new, says a groggy Iowan before returning to blissful slumber and dreams of eating pancakes with Mike Pompeo and scotcheroos with Rick Scott. Okay, so it wasn't a courageous writer. It was a couple of news stories, one from Politico with a daunting headline, Dems Could Dethrone Iowa. It seems, according to Politico and its sources, Democratic leaders are considering shaking up the party's presidential nominating process. They might even shove Iowa and New Hampshire from their proud perches at the starting line. Former U.S. Senate Democratic leader Harry Reid thinks his home state of Nevada would be a better place to start the primary process. U.S. Representative Jim Clyburn of South Carolina says his state could lead the pack. Both states, they argue, are far more diverse than Iowa. Overwhelmingly white Iowa, 90%, and New Hampshire, 89%, don't look much like the diverse Democratic electorate that helped Joe Biden win states such as Georgia and Arizona. Biden barely finished in the top four in Iowa's caucuses. I don't think it's appropriate to have those two states to set the tone. It's really a false premise that if you do well in Iowa and New Hampshire, you're going to do well across the country. That was proved wrong with Joe Biden, Reid told Politico. There's no diversity in Iowa. There's certainly no diversity in New Hampshire. Also, caucuses, which require people to show up for a political meeting to express their presidential preference, are out of step with Democrats' push to make voting easier and more accessible, particularly early voting. Oh, and there was that small matter of Iowa being unable to report results from the 2020 Democratic caucus due to tabulation issues, both human and technical. The Associated Press still has not declared a winner. Maybe that's why Tulsi Gabbard left her billboards up. With the exception of that 2020 debacle, which a review by state Democrats blamed on meddling by the Democratic National Committee, these mostly are perennial criticism of the caucuses. But not everyone was willing to shrug off this dethroning business. Attacking the Iowa caucuses and other first-in-the-nation states is nothing new for people like Harry Reid and coastal elites who think they know better than everybody else. I continue to stand shoulder to shoulder with my first-in-the-nation states counterparts and will do everything in my power to protect the Iowa caucuses, Republican Party of Iowa Chairman Jeff Kaufman said in response to the Politico piece. It's always the coastal elites. But Kaufman has much less to worry about. Republican toe dippers already are wading into Iowa, even as Donald Trump looms over the proceedings like an overinflated orange parade balloon. But for Iowa Democrats, the intensity of the caucus pummeling from their national leadership has intensified. Defense is difficult. The caucuses are archaic and inaccessible, and efforts to make them less so have run into snags. Iowa does lack diversity. But hey, we can look candidates in the eye and kick their tires and jaw with them in cafes. How will we know who can be president if they haven't flipped a single state fair pork chop? We all know a primary would solve a lot of problems. Johnson County Democrats approved a resolution this month calling for the change, but going that direction sparks war with New Hampshire, where state law says it must hold the first primary, and Secretary of State Bill Gardner will move the primary to a week from Sunday if it means staying first. On top of all that, Iowa is no longer a swing state. Why would Democrats want to start the nomination process in a Trumpy red state where the eventual nominee has no chance of winning? Of course, losing the caucuses would be yet another debilitating blow to a state party already stumbling. There is good news. You can't replace something with nothing, and as usual, the folks lining up to bash Iowa have no solid alternative plan. Maybe Iowa, New Hampshire, Nevada, and South Carolina could hold contests on the same day, but multi-state primaries also would give candidates with bags of money an advantage over lesser-known candidates who might catch on in a cheaper state-by-state process. Remember Jimmy Carter? Barack Obama? If Democrats want to start in the Midwest, they can go with a Rust Belt state that now looms large on their electoral map. But which one goes first? Or maybe a multi-state Rust Belt primary, which also has that multi-state money problem. There are a lot of ideas, but no consensus. That saved Iowa before and likely will again. It still is a free country. If candidates and journalists think Iowa's caucuses are hopelessly flawed, unfixable, and bad for the country, they can opt to not come here. The caucuses have become an overblown circus because of all the attention they're given. All that glare has exposed and exacerbated the once quaint caucus's weaknesses. But the gravitational pull of Iowa is hard to resist. Candidates are convinced they'll look presidential standing amid hay bales. Journalists will go where the candidates go. They'll write about our down-to-earth rustic charm and also our barren, frozen landscape where desperate Americans endure without hope or almond milk. It's irresistible. As an Iowan and a follower of politics, I don't want to see the caucuses tossed from the leadoff spot. I'd rather see changes made that make them far more accessible while yielding results that are not unintelligible. Smart people are working on it. If they fail, let's have a primary. But I'm also a realist. The criticism of the caucuses are largely fair. It's been a great run, but times, politics, and party priorities change. If leaders find a reasonable alternative to the Iowa-New Hampshire tradition that better serves the party and the nation, so be it. The fair will go on without presidential pork flippers. The Washington Post reports that the DNC will schedule meetings starting in May to discuss the nominating process. Our lone writer will be happy to know they'll be streamed on YouTube. Community letters today in the political cartoon from Joe Heller of Green Bay. The kids and dad are dying and coloring Easter eggs, and the daughter says to the son, "Dad sure is looking forward to baseball season, as dad appears to be decorating his egg with baseball stitches." The first letter is from Michelle Sparrowgrove of Cedar Rapids. "So much trash makes Cedar Rapids look dirty. I haven't lived in Cedar Rapids as long as a lot of people, but the trash that is all over our city makes it look so dirty. There are businesses with trash all over their property. There are neighborhoods that have trash, broken furniture, and mattresses laying around. I know most of it wasn't seen until all the snow melted, and I know the wind has a lot to do with blowing it all around. But come on, the wind isn't going to clean up, so someone has to. Show pride in what you have. Michelle Sparrowgrove of Cedar Rapids." The next letter is from Russ Lenth of Iowa City. "Doonesbury Mallard Fillmore should get the axe. Years ago, a lot of newspapers stopped running Doonesbury on the comics page due to pressure from some groups contending it was too political. At that time, I was not a subscriber, but I suppose that the Gazette decided to run Mallard Fillmore alongside Doonesbury in the Insight section in order to present some semblance of balance in those daily political cartoons. Now, and for the past several years, Doonesbury has been rerunning old strips while Mallard Fillmore continues to run new comics every day, with current commentary reflecting views from the right. It is a joke to think this provides any kind of reasonable balance between left and right political views. In my view, neither strip contributes much in the way of editorial discourse. Mallard is predictable and Doonesbury is outdated. I think the Gazette should discontinue both strips and make a little bit more room for some other forms of commentary." Russ Lenth of Iowa City. Next, Mike Streb of Iowa City writes, "Abortion amendment is not understood. What accounts for the seeming opposition of Iowans to the proposed amendment to the state constitution pertaining to abortion? Iowa poll, most don't support anti-abortion amendment, Gazette, March 27th. A great deal of confusion surrounds the amendment. If Iowans are asked if all abortions should be constitutionally banned without exception, many will answer no. However, the proposed amendment does no such thing. The Iowa Supreme Court, in its ruling, created a constitutional right to abortion. The amendment would just reverse the decision. Under Roe v. Wade and subsequent court rulings, states have very limited ability to impose abortion restrictions. Unless and until Roe is reversed, that will remain the case. If states are allowed to restrict abortion, the Iowa Supreme Court's ruling would preclude the legislature from considering restrictions on even the most egregious late-term abortions. I doubt that Iowans support tying legislators' hands to that extent. As with most polls, responses hinge on how the question is posed. Mike Streb of Iowa City. Next, Robin Tucker writes, "Will partisan politics affect mayor's race?" Do we need to be concerned about hyper-partisan elements entering our local elections again in 2021? The first vote of the 15-member Home Rule Charter Commission in 2004 and 2005 was a motion led by Cedar Rapids resident and former publisher of the Gazette, Joe Hladke, that our local government should be nonpartisan in nature. At the time, as the soon-to-be drafting chair of the commission, it also indicated to me that the council manager form should be pursued under our proposed Home Rule Charter. The other discussed form at the time, the mayor-council form, is historically partisan. Now we're witnessing a new candidate, Amara Andrews, who has party mechanics behind her campaign for local mayor. It's hardly nonpartisan when the fundraising affiliations of the Democratic Party are being utilized. That includes Act Blue, an American nonprofit technology organization established in June 2004 that establishes left-leaning nonprofits, Democratic candidates, and progressive groups to raise money from individual donors on the internet by providing them with online fundraising software. Watching Andrews' announcement unfold on social media, it made me wonder what my former commissioner and Southeast neighbor Joe Hladke would have to say today. I ran in 2007 for city council and raised concerns of partisan elements growing in local government. It appears that it has been taken to another level. Robin Tucker of Cedar Rapids. And the final letter is from Karen M. Kodrowski, director of the Carrie Chapman Catt Center for Women in Politics. Correcting record on Carrie Chapman Catt. I'm writing in response to the article by Vanessa Miller, first up for renaming debate at Iowa State, Catt Hall, March 15th. Ms. Miller quotes from two requests to rename Catt Hall that express common misperceptions that the 19th Amendment enfranchised only white women and that Catt supported this goal. Carrie Chapman Catt grew up in Iowa and graduated from Iowa State in 1880. She was president of the National American Women's Suffrage Association, NWASA, from 1900 to 1904 and 1915 to 1920. Catt designed its winning plan that led to the 19th Amendment's ratification. The 19th Amendment did not enfranchise white women only. Catt opposed any effort to insert the word white into the amendment. Moreover, the South was steadfastly opposed to suffrage because it would enfranchise African American women and thus undermine its system of white supremacy. African American suffrage organizations were members of the NAWSA. On several occasions, Catt advocated for suffrage for all Americans, irrespective of race or ethnicity, and as a member of the Committee of 100 in New York, she asked Congress to enforce the 15th Amendment. Catt's support of African Americans' voting rights was cited by her opponents in state ratification debates. The 19th Amendment is the single largest expansion of voting rights in the nation's history, enfranchising some 26 million Americans. Approximately 500,000 African American women lived in the states, including Iowa, that did not restrict voting rights and were able to vote in 1920. That was Karen M. Kodrowski, director of the Carrie Chapman Catt Center for Women in Politics. You are listening to the reading of the Cedar Rapids Gazette for Sunday, April 4th, 2021. I am your reader, Sharon Faldudo, and we turn to the obituaries page. Ray Kleenow, age 90 of Monticello, died Thursday, April 1st. Getch Funeral Home of Monticello handling arrangements. Richard Clamorous, age 75, of Cedar Rapids, known as Rich, died Tuesday, February 23rd, at his home. Memorial service, 11 a.m. Saturday, April 10th, at Murdoch Linwood Funeral Home and Cremation Service, Cedar Rapids, with visitation to begin 1 hour prior. A reception will immediately follow the service, the memorial service, at IBEW Local 405, 1211 Wiley Boulevard Southwest in Cedar Rapids. All guests driving street rods are asked to park in the reserve space in the west side parking lot facing Wiley Boulevard. All other guests are asked to use the parking lot on the east side of the building. Private burial will take place at Sisley Grove Cemetery, Cedar Rapids. All guests are respectfully requested to wear a mask and practice social distancing. Joan Glenda Mass, 86, of Cedar Rapids, peacefully went home to her Savior Jesus on November 2nd. A celebration of life will be held from 2 to 4 p.m. Saturday, April 10th, at Trinity Lutheran Church on 1st Avenue Southwest in Cedar Rapids. Curtis Robert Pierce, known as Kurt, age 68, of Cedar Rapids, passed peacefully in his sleep in his home on Wednesday, March 24th. Kurt worked for the City of Cedar Rapids Water Department for many years. He retired from there and spent the rest of his days visiting friends and family. He enjoyed his road trips, and no one was a stranger to him. In 2011, he became an honorary member of the E. Clampisvitus Frank C. Riley Chapter, 5978 LaPorte, Rabbit Creek in California. In the more recent years, he participated in bell ringing around the holidays and loved it. He also spent a lot of his time collecting food and other things for those in need. A celebration of life will be held at a later date. Joseph R. Nassif, 69, of Cedar Rapids, passed away suddenly on March 26th. There will be a small funeral service for immediate family. All invited guests are respectfully requested to wear a mask and practice social distancing. Murdoch Linwood Funeral Home and Cremation Service in Cedar Rapids is assisting the family. Joe worked for many years at HACAP, helping the elderly find jobs until his retirement in 2011. He was passionate about his hobbies and could often be found on the golf course playing bridge or watching sports with his daughter Leah, cousins, and friends. He enjoyed many genres of music and would frequently attend the symphony with his wife Jane. Joe also loved watching The Office and Psych with his daughter Sadie, and they would often quote their favorite lines to each other. He loved to travel all over the United States with his family, going for golf trips and taking his girls to their favorite places such as Walt Disney World and Disneyland. No matter where he was or what he did, Joe's family always came first and was the most important thing in the world to him. Michael Wilson, known as Mike, age 72, of Cedar Rapids, passed away on Tuesday, March 30th at St. Luke's Hospice, Cedar Rapids, following a lengthy illness. A celebration of life will take place at a later date. Stuart Baxter Funeral and Memorial Service, Cedar Rapids, is caring for Mike and his family. Mike worked for the city of Cedar Rapids in forestry for many years and later in life for himself doing maintenance work. Mike enjoyed the outdoors, especially fishing and mushroom and asparagus hunting. He was a talented house painter, completing many home renovations over the years. He was known as a funny guy to his friends and will be missed by those who knew him. Wanda Lynn O'Brien, 64, of Iowa City, passed away on March 27th. She was the mother of four sons, Chad, Chris, Greg, and James. There will be no local services. Dale R. Hammer, 92, lifetime resident of the Iowa City area, died Thursday, April 9th, 2020, at the University of Iowa Hospitals and Clinics. Services celebrating Dale's life will be held Saturday, April 10th at 2 p.m., where visitation will take place from noon to 2 p.m. at the Knights of Columbus Family Center in Iowa City. Military honors will be provided for the Richmond AMVETs. Casual wear is encouraged in the true spirit of Dale. Dawn C. Rogers, 80, a lifelong resident of the Iowa City area, passed away from natural causes on Saturday, April 11th, 2020, at a local care center. Dawn chose to be cremated. A time for family and friends to gather to remember Dawn will be held from 3 to 5 p.m. Saturday, April 10th at Gay and Shia Funeral and Cremation Service. Private family burial services will take place at Oakland Cemetery in Iowa City. LaVon Helen Hammond, 87, of Kelowna, passed away. I am not sure on what date. On August... Nope. I apologize. LaVon endeavored to persevere. LaVon loved her kids, her grandkids, and her great-grandkids. She loved Frank Sinatra and Barry Manilow. She loved reading, scrapbooking, and playing cards. She says she always played by the rules, but others in the family disagree. Visitation for LaVon will occur from 10 to 10:45 a.m. Saturday, April 10th at St. Mary of the Visitation Catholic Church, 302 East Jefferson Street in Iowa City. A mass of Christian burial will take place immediately following the visitation at 11 a.m. Following mass, LaVon will be buried next to her late husband, George Sr., at Oakland Cemetery, 1000 Brown Street, Iowa City. Carolyn Joyce Konismark of Mason City, age 88, passed away peacefully on Wednesday, March 31st, at Heritage Care and Rehabilitation Center in Mason City. Due to COVID-19, private family services will be held in Memorial Park Cemetery. Joyce was a fierce competitor in bowling, golf, bridge, and board games, but basketball was the core of her life. She acted as a second mother to many players on the NICC Trojans basketball team. She made many meals and baked many pies. The door was always open for players to join the family at holidays and other times. She spent countless nights at games and supported a variety of teams and players at both NIACC and Mason City High School. She was honored when selected to represent the community and Mason City High School for her sportsmanship and strong character at the 2015 Girls State High School Basketball Tournament, where she received a plaque and a check for $250 to give to the MCHS Scholarship Fund. Mary Ann Stegan, 88, of Strawberry Point, passed away on Tuesday, March 30th, at the Journey House Hospice in Lincoln, Nebraska. Funeral service, 11 a.m. Saturday, April 10th, at Mission in Christ Lutheran Church in Strawberry Point, with Pastor Gary Burkhalter officiating. Visitation, 4 to 7 p.m. Friday, April 9th, at Leonard Muller Funeral Home in Strawberry Point. Friends may also call 1 hour before services at the church on Saturday morning. Interment, Cass Township Cemetery in Strawberry Point. Benjamin Lloyd Wright Sr., 95, of Swisher, died on Wednesday, March 10th. Services 10:30 a.m. Friday at TN Funeral Home. Burial Linwood Cemetery. Friends may visit with the family on Thursday from 4 to 7 p.m. at TN Funeral Home. Per COVID-19 guidelines, attendees are asked to wear masks and practice social distancing. Ben enjoyed collecting antiques and spending time with his boys on the farm and couldn't wait to play cards after cookouts with Joan and their kids. He and Joan loved being snowbirds during the winters, but they were always happy to be back home to see their children and grandchildren. Rita Schulte Hunter, 91, of Grand Rapids, Michigan, passed away peacefully Monday, March 29th. Rita was a homemaker and a love of travel, and she and her husband traveled the world together. Rita will be laid to rest at Graceland Memorial Park Mausoleum. Due to current restrictions, private family services will be held. And Karen L. Harford, age 80, of Lincoln, Nebraska, passed away on Monday, March 29th. Karen was born to Vernon and Irene Clark. A visitation will be held from 4 to 7 p.m. Wednesday, April 7th at Lincoln Memorial Funeral Home, 6800 South 14th Street, Lincoln, Nebraska, with a funeral service following at 10 a.m. Thursday, April 8th at First Evangelical Free Church, 3280 South 84th Street, Lincoln. Turning to the sports page, Iowa men's basketball. Iowa's Garza, winner of Naismith Trophy, also repeats as winner of Kareem Abdul-Jabbar Award by Mike Loss of the Gazette. Iowa's Luca Garza was named the winner of the men's Naismith Trophy on Saturday for the National College Player of the Year. Garza is the first Hawkeye to receive the honor since it debuted in 1969. The finalists were selected by the Atlanta Tip-Off Club's National Voting Academy, comprised of journalists, current and former head coaches, former award winners, and conference commissioners. Garza averaged 24.1 points and 8.7 rebounds for the 22-9 Hawkeyes. He made 55.3% of his field goal attempts and 44% of his three-point tries and had 50 block shots. Past winners of the award include Kareem Abdul-Jabbar, Bill Walton, Larry Bird, Michael Jordan, and Tim Duncan. "For me, it's a team award," Garza said Saturday in Indianapolis. "I hope I've given half as much back to the University of Iowa as it has given me." Garza is the seventh Big Ten player to get the honor and first since Wisconsin's Frank Kaminsky in 2015. He had already been tapped Associated Press's Player of the Year and winner of every other National Player of the Year honor announced so far this year. Later in the day, Garza was the repeat recipient of the Kareem Abdul-Jabbar Center of the Year Award by the Naismith Memorial Basketball Hall of Fame. Garza is the first player to win that award multiple times. The John R. Wooden Award will be announced Tuesday. Garza is a finalist along with Illinois' Io Desunmu, Gonzaga's Corey Kispert, Baylor's Jared Butler, and Oklahoma State's Cade Cunningham. If Garza wins the Wooden Award, he will be the consensus player of the year. The winner of the Women's Naismith Trophy was Connecticut freshman Paige Buechers. Also from the sports page, salvaging a future, Iowa men's gymnastics. Could a self-sustaining budget keep Iowa men's gymnastics alive? By John Stepp of the Gazette. With the end of the men's gymnastics season looming, no one needs to remind Iowa coach J.D. Rive, the countdown to the end of my employment with athletics is imminent. 7 months ago, the University of Iowa announced plans to cut 4 sports, including men's gymnastics. The Big Ten championships were held Saturday, and NCAA championships are April 16th and 17th. That will mark the final meet for the program founded 99 years ago. But Rive has hope for the program's future, albeit in an unconventional form. Iowa is among the programs pursuing a self-sustaining budget model to keep competitive collegiate men's gymnastics in Iowa City. Rive is looking to do something similar to what Minnesota men's gymnastics coach Mike Burns has proposed. Under the proposal designed with help from the College Gymnastics Association, the development of a youth club program affiliated with the team covers the expenses. It then operates as a club team outside the purview of the athletics department and NCAA. Why don't we just take the profit from a gymnastics club and redirect it to supporting a collegiate club program, a collegiate varsity program, Burns said. Joshua Gordon, a sports business professor at the University of Oregon, says it's an intriguing business model. "I like what they're trying to do," Gordon said. "They're trying to create a broader network of stakeholders that can help prop it up and diversify where money comes from." Iowa would still be able to compete against the remaining Division I teams with NCAA affiliations, including Big Ten rivals such as Nebraska or Illinois. There is a precedent for this type of business model. Arizona State's athletics department cuts men's gymnastics in 1993, but it has operated with a self-sustaining budget since then. The club team still competed against California, an NCAA-affiliated team, in 2021. Reeves said Arizona State's success outside of its intercollegiate athletics department is the gold standard. Minnesota and Iowa have looked at Arizona State's model while building their plans, although the Big Ten schools don't have quite the same benefits. "He's got palm trees," Reeves said with a laugh. "We have snow." Palm trees aside, the financially independent cost structure is not easy to implement. Burns described it as a labor of love. Along with coaching gymnastics, the model requires the coach to essentially launch a business at the same time. I've never had to think about what I'm thinking about now, so I've evolved, Burns said. In this situation, if you don't evolve, you're not going to survive. Iowa Men's Gymnastics spent $999,586 and made $76,813 in revenue in the 2019 fiscal year, the most recent year with financial numbers unaffected by COVID-19, according to public records obtained by the Gazette. Along with bringing in revenue as a youth club, the Minnesota model projects a budget about half the size of what gymnastics spent in 2019. It seems a little rosy in spots if you dig into the numbers, Gordon said. It's a lot riding on a lot going right, and that should be a little scary. Burns is farther along than Reeve in the process of converting the program into a financially independent option. Leadership for Minnesota's Recreation and Wellness Department is bending over backward, Burns said, to help. Minnesota also has a much larger pool of youth gymnasts in the area. The Minneapolis-St. Paul metropolitan area has more than 3.6 million people. The Iowa City and Cedar Rapids metropolitan areas have less than 500,000 people combined. There are some barriers to entry for sure, Reeve said. If you try to scale that down to Iowa City, I think it's possible you can do it, but you need to be a lot more creative in terms of marketing and spacing and what does the facility look like. Reeve thinks it could take 5 years to implement the model in Iowa City. He said COVID-19 has slowed progress. Otherwise, he said it might have taken 3 years. The pandemic has put such a limit on hypothesizing what business models are going to look like and how many people are going to want to come back and do activities like this, Reeve said. His athletes are willing to stick around, though, to start the transition. After Iowa and Minnesota are cut after this season, the NCAA will be down to 13 Division I men's gymnastics programs in the country, limiting transfer opportunities. Reeve said he's received support from the athletics department, including athletics director Gary Barta, which is a big part of making the transition work. Athletics still carries a whole lot of weight and authority around campus, Reeve said. His wife, Donnie Thompson, owns IS Gymnastics, allowing Reeve to dedicate significant time to developing the self-sustaining model. Reeve believes the addition of more youth gymnastics in the area would help, not hurt, other clubs in eastern Iowa. I've always been a believer in rising tides lift all ships, Reeve said. Reeve, who founded a gymnastics club while he was an assistant coach at Stanford, said ideally the self-sustaining model will drive more interest in the sport and therefore help other clubs. Paige Roth, the owner of the Iowa Gymnast in Coralville, said she typically has three boys in the club competitive enough for a division at for consideration at a Division I program like Iowa. Most of her customers are looking for ways to stay active or training for other sports, especially wrestling. The majority of our kids who come through here are not going to be kids, whether they're male or female, who are going to be looking for a college scholarship, Roth said. The number of kids who aspire to do college gymnastics has always been a very small percentage. Roth still has a stake in the future of Iowa men's gymnastics program, albeit more emotional than financial. For someone who has been involved in the sport of gymnastics since I was 2 years old, it's very sad for me to see these programs going away, Roth said. Burns believes lower high school participation rates for boys' gymnastics may have put the sport more so on the chopping block than other non-revenue-generating NCAA sports. The National Federation of State High School Associations indicated 1,580 boys participated in school-sponsored gymnastics in the 2018-19 school year, 225 more boys than in school-sponsored canoe paddling and 342 fewer boys than in school-sponsored bass fishing. But the vast majority of boy gymnasts compete through clubs like Roth's or Thompson's that are not affiliated with the high school and therefore not included in the NFHS report. These kids go to high school, but they don't compete at high school, Burns said. They compete for private clubs. That's just the nature of our sport. As unfortunate as a reality as this is for Reeve and Burns, it doesn't come as a surprise. Burns has seen plenty of other programs fold during his 40-plus years of coaching, which includes an 11-year stint as an assistant coach at Iowa. I've always kind of woken up every day looking over my shoulder going, yeah, we're still here. This is good, Burns said. So it's kind of this black cloud that sort of follows everybody around in this sport. From the Iowa Today, Iowa City's attorney retiring after 25 years by Lee Hermiston of the Gazette. The role of the city attorney is vast, particularly in communities as large as Iowa City. Broadly, city attorneys represent city departments and staff, the city council, and boards in legal matters. Those can range from employment and property law to economic development to planning and zoning. For Iowa City Attorney Eleanor Dilks, it all boils down to finding and solving problems. A good attorney is good at spotting issues, Dilks said. If you can't spot issues, you can't function well as an attorney. For a quarter century, Dilks has been spotting and addressing issues for Iowa City. Hired as an assistant city attorney in 1996, Dilks has been the city's lead attorney since 1997. She is set to retire April 16th. I've been working since I was 14 years old, she said. It's almost unimaginable that I'm going to wake up Monday the 19th and not go to work. Born in Tennessee, Dilks grew up in Iowa City, graduated from City High, and attended the University of Iowa for her undergraduate degree and law school. After college, Dilks worked at a large firm in Minneapolis before joining a small private practice in Iowa City. But after 7 years, Dilks said she didn't like the work and decided to apply for a position with the city. That decision proved to be a wise one for Dilks, who is always seeking a new challenge. "I have never been bored at this job," she said. "There's always something new. There's always a reason why my mind has to work pretty hard to figure things out. That's challenging work." Dilks has helped the city navigate a plethora of legal issues, from affordable housing to state legislation challenging local efforts. Most Tuesday nights, she can be found offering legal advice to the city council, ensuring meetings are properly conducted. "The hardest thing for me to get used to when I became a city attorney was giving legal advice in a public setting," Dilks said. "Most of the time in other practice areas, you give your client advice confidentially. In this setting, you're often answering questions that you haven't been asked when you're sitting in a public meeting. That took some real getting used to for me." Dilks said the other difficult part of her job is when the political discourse becomes personal and mean-spirited. "That continues to be hard," she said. "That's hard for everybody, and it's not productive." But Dilks said she has enjoyed working with an incredible staff of attorneys, legal assistants, and city employees over the years. As far as Dilks knows, she's Iowa City's longest-serving city attorney and is proud of what she's accomplished in that time. "I would say that I have for 25 years in an environment that is at times difficult and politically charged, provided good quality legal advice in a timely manner, and been an effective member of the city team that is dedicated to implementing the goals of the city council," she said. Assistant City Attorney Eric Goers, who has worked alongside Dilks since 2005, said her best traits are her exceptional work ethic, her ability to quickly decipher even the most complicated or nuanced legal issues, and her dedication to her staff. He also praised Dilks' troubleshooting capabilities. "She's very knowledgeable about municipal law, but she's also a problem solver," Goers said. "She looks to see what council and the city manager are hoping to achieve and does her best to find a way to get there." City manager Jeff Fruin said Dilks has been far more than just a city attorney. He describes Dilks as a trusted mentor who has helped the city face its challenges. "Her creative thinking and solutions-oriented approach to her work enabled us to accomplish so much as a community," Fruin said. "Having Eleanor on our team has been the equivalent of having a city attorney, city manager, and department director all wrapped up in one person." Added Fruin, "Her leadership and positive influence in our organization has been immeasurable and will be missed greatly. Her legacy extends far behind specific projects and will be seen in the team she has led and employees she has mentored and inspired during her tenure." Dilks said she isn't quite sure what retirement will hold for her. "She has no intention of leaving Iowa City and looks forward to spending time with family and friends, reading, gardening, and running. She's planning her fourth attempt at piano lessons as well. I worry about not having the intellectual challenges, but other than that, I don't have any doubt that I will occupy my time," she said. "I've been advised by other people who retired that it's best to give myself a year before making any major commitments. I'm hoping to be true to that and just take some time, take at least a year to figure out how it is I want to live the rest of my life." And turning to the time machine, a look back at people, places, and events in Eastern Iowa. Passion Plays, Productions presented Life of Christ in Iowa Stops by Diane Fannin Langton, a correspondent. Passion Plays, the dramatic representations of the suffering, death, and resurrection of Jesus Christ, began in medieval Europe as a way to teach a largely illiterate population the biblical story. The tradition traces back to 1242 AD to the Kappenburg Monastery in Germany, but it was the version presented in Freiburg, Germany that found its way to the United States beginning in the 1920s. Alfred E. Wolff picked brothers Adolf and Georg Fasnacht to manage the family's Freiburg Passion Play. The production came to the United States in August 1928 for the dedication of the Krug Open Air Bowl in St. Joseph, Missouri. In 1929, the production stopped in Cedar Rapids for February 12th through 14th performances at the El Cahir Shrine Temple. It was the seventh city on the tour and the second in Iowa after Des Moines. Billed as the Great Passion Play of Freiburg, the production was promoted as having its origin in that German city in 1264, when a plague almost wiped out the city. A vow was made that if the pestilence were lifted, a passion play would be given by the citizens every 10 years, promotional materials said. The company that will enact this drama in Cedar Rapids will give the exact reproduction of the performances those years. And it was an exact reproduction, with all the dialogue in German and an English translation in the program. Frank Waller of the Chicago Civic Opera was the production's musical director. As was the practice in each city, a local orchestra, the Cedar Rapids Symphony Orchestra, and a large chorus of local people were enlisted for the performances. The company was in Davenport in March 1929, when the Fasnacht brothers began arguing after New York theatrical producer Morris Guest saw a performance and persuaded Georg to bring the company to New York. By October, Georg severed connections with the Freiburg players and began organizing an English-speaking company to produce the play. This group's first English production was in the Civic Opera House in Chicago in May 1930. The Players also appeared in Burlington and Mason City in November 1930, performing in English after the cast began intensive English lessons with a German-American actor. Both of the brothers had to return to Germany when their passports expired, but Adolf brought his company back in May 1932, choosing Cedar Rapids for the June 15th-18th premiere of his second American tour, this one in English. The tour included Joseph Meyer in the role of John the Beloved. At some point, Joseph Meyer, the one who had played John, reorganized the play, taking the role of Christ and renaming the organization for his hometown of Leuenen, Germany. His first production was in Pittsburgh. Meyer said the atmosphere in Germany, where Adolf Hitler was coming to power, was like the calm before a summer storm. He decided to stay in the United States. He became a citizen in 1933 and married a cast member, Claire Hume of Chicago. The couple had a daughter in 1938, whose first role in the play was that of the baby Jesus. By February 1939, Meyer's Passion Play had performed in Iowa, at Fort Madison, Des Moines, and Carroll before it stopped in Cedar Rapids. The Cedar Rapids performance was February 19th and 20th at Memorial Coliseum, with local church and high school choirs joining the production. The troupe returned to the Coliseum in 1944 during World War II. In an interview with the Gazette, Meyer said the Passion Plays in Germany weren't openly suppressed by the Nazis. The Passion Play was associated so intimately with the people that it wouldn't have been, well, the intelligent thing to do, he said. The Nazis found a better way. They drafted all manpower connected with the Passion Plays and made it impossible for the plays to go on. In 1937, Meyer found a perfect permanent home for his company in a natural amphitheater in South Dakota's Black Hills. The theater was easily accessible to tourists, and locals were willing to help support the theater troupe. The Passion Play was presented three times a week from June through September against the backdrop of Lookout Mountain near Spearfish. It then traveled to indoor venues the remainder of the year. Following the deaths of Joseph Meyer in 1999 and his wife in 2007, and after 69 summer seasons in the amphitheater, the last performance of the Black Hills Passion Play was August 31, 2008. According to the Rapid City Journal, more than 10 million people had seen the play by then. And that brings us to the end of the reading of the Cedar Rapids Gazette for Sunday, April 4th, 2021. I've been your reader, Sharon Falduto, and remember that you can access a recording of this or any other IRIS recordings on our website at any time, iowaradioreading.org. Thank you for listening.